This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands. Good morning, everyone. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, 26th of August, 2025. We'd like to thank the Radioactive Show that you were listening to earlier, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. On today's show, we have Juliet, and I'm back at the panel this morning, so this is nice. I'm feeling like a pilot again.
Yeah, well, no, we're happy to have you here today, Faiza.
How have you been, Juliet?
I've been good. It was a big weekend.
Yeah.
Went to the rally on Sunday, which was,
oh my goodness,
so massive.
It was incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just kept hearing about how even when we got to Flinders Street Station,
yeah,
there were people still on Swanston. And
yeah,
then by the time we got up to Parliament, there were still people in Little Collins. It was just,
yeah,
so incredible to hear.
It was. Yeah. It was. Yeah, yeah. I think even my parents were saying they want to come now. So,
oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah,
oh,
I'm which so is good exciting. To hear that. Yeah, yeah.
That's yeah. good. Yeah, yeah. No, it was really good to finally see good numbers. Especially for in NAM, we've been rallying for so long, so it was actually there were quite a lot of tears, I think, on site, like, you know, just emotional seeing the sheer volume of people. So that was beautiful. So but a bit more on that, I guess, in headlines today, unfortunately, as well. But let's do a rundown on today's show. First up.
Yeah, so we're going to start off chatting to Kate Wiley from Doctors for the Environment. And Kate is coming back on the program to give us some updates on the federal court's decision to uphold the approval of the Scarborough Gas Project's environment plan. So we're going to be finding out about that.
And at 7:30, we'll be listening to Jen from Women on the Line, who spoke with 44 Flats United, a group of residents, former residents and supporters of public housing who are organising against the Victoria State Government's decision to demolish the 44 high-rise commission flats, as well as a growing number of walk-ups across NAM. At 7:45, we'll be listening to Alexis Fuentes, who spoke at the Pacific Peace Conference, which was organized by the Pacific Peace Network. Alexis will be discussing the spoke at a panel called Regional War Preparations, and we'll be discussing the rising militarism in the Indo-Pacific as well as the resistance against global imperialism.
And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be chatting to April Howard, who's a film producer of the upcoming documentary Voices of the Pacific. And April recently attended the Plastics Treaty and is going to be sharing her experience attending that and also chat about the global threat of plastics in our oceans and how the documentary focuses on those issues. And then finally at 8:15, we're going to listen to a speech from Tasnim Samarkas, a Palestinian educator, researcher and organizer who spoke at a recent event, Radiance in Pain and Resilience, which was a public lecture and panel. And we're going to hear about Tasnim's academic work and their community involvement as well.
Incredible. So, an absolutely busy show, and I love the variety we have today. But first, our news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 26th of August, 2025. At least 4 Palestinian journalists are among 14 people killed in an Israeli attack on Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza. This brings the number of journalists martyred to 244. According to Hind Khoudary, reporting for Al Jazeera from Deir el-Bala, the Israeli forces launched an explosive suicide drone where it hit the rooftop of Nasser Hospital, where at least a journalist was killed. As civil defense teams attempted to rescue the wounded and journalists were documenting what had happened, the Israeli forces launched another airstrike at the exact same location, an act which was documented on air. Journalists who were covering the initial attack were killed and wounded, along with civil defense teams. According to Hind, there are many Palestinian journalists reporting from hospitals as they are following the wounded Palestinians, reporting on funerals and malnutrition cases. Due to Israel's blockade, Palestinian journalists are also accessing electricity and internet at hospitals in order to continue reporting.
Also in the news, groups of Australians are planning to demonstrate this Sunday at the racist far-right March for Australia protests, which call for an end to what organizers have described as mass migration and reclamation of so-called Australia's identity. Organizers claim endless migration, weak leadership, and political cowardice have caused Australia to change in ways most of us have never agreed to. In response, Indian influencers and community leaders have been urging immigrants from the country living in Australia to stay inside and avoid protests for your safety. Social media influencer Mandeep Singh posts a video questioning whether migrants would be safe on August 31st. Last week, the Federation of Ethnic Communities Councils of Australia issued a statement on the rally saying singling out new arrivals or culturally diverse communities ignores our shared history. Meanwhile, the weekly Palestine rally in Melbourne will be commencing earlier this Sunday, gathering at the State Library at 11 a.m. to counter the March for Australia.
In other news this week, a new report by independent public interest think tank Climate Energy Finance, the CEF, finds that Australia's largest taxpayer-funded fossil fuel subsidy, the diesel fuel tax credit, the FTC scheme, is entrenching dependence on imported high emissions diesel to power mining operations, undermining climate targets, damaging productivity, and draining tens of billions from the federal budget. The CEF argues that the scheme, mostly benefiting big miners, needs urgent reform. A proposal backed by iron ore giant and fuel tax credit recipient Fortescue. The CEF proposes that communities be required to reinvest any fuel tax credits above a $50 million annual cap into clean energy diesel alternatives or forego these credits. At the moment, top FTC recipient companies claim hundreds of millions of dollars in credits annually. The current scheme disincentivizes our world-leading mining industry from shifting capital into decarbonization and electrification here, such as electric mining trucks and renewables infrastructure. And finally, in headlines, women who blow the whistle are vital to exposing wrongdoing but are paying a heavy price for their courage. According to a new report released by the Human Rights Law Centre just yesterday, a report titled Women Speaking Up, Gender Dynamics in Australia's Whistleblowing Landscape analyses data from the Human Rights Law Centre's Whistleblower Project, Australia's first specialist legal service for whistleblowers, and had several key findings on the gendered nature of whistleblowing. For example, women are more likely to speak up about the endangerment of people, while men are more likely to report fraud or corruption. Although men and women suffer reprisal at the same rate, women are more likely to face harassment and bullying in the workplace because of their whistleblowing disclosures. The report makes a number of recommendations to better protect women who blow the whistle, including establishing a whistleblower protection authority, which recognises and incorporates women's experiences of speaking up. And these have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 26th of August, 2025. And you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Capitalism's inherent barbarism is on full display, from the genocide in Gaza and the rise of the far right, to growing militarism and the climate crisis.
We need to radically change the way society is organised.
Join us for the upcoming Eco-Socialism 2025 conference, Eco-Socialism, Not Barbarism, held on September 5th to the 7th at the Balam Place in Brunswick.
We will be bringing together activists from across the Indo-Pacific, sharing experiences to resist capitalism's drive to barbarism and build the mass movements that we need.
Anyone who wants to be part of the discussion on how we can build a left-wing alternative is welcome to attend.
Featuring international guests from the United States, Pakistan, India, Malaysia, and Brazil, along with local campaigners.
Organised by Green Left and Socialist Alliance. Find out more by going to ecosocialism.org.au.
Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
Now we're going to listen to a song, Gentle Boy by Araminta, who's a Nam-based singer-songwriter, and this is her new release.
Fine piece of art made by the Greek gods.
Who would have thought I was strong and so mighty?
Could love you harder than Aphrodite.
Baby, be kind and watch your timing. I'll make a storm, Zeus, type of lightning.
To us, the people, We need a treaty in this country. We need the end to the war in this country. And the only way we can do that is through a peace treaty. Not the one you see in Victoria, not the one you see in Queensland, not the one you see in the Northern Territory, because they talk treaty and still lock our people up. They still kill our people. They still desecrate our land and our water. A treaty means peace. A treaty means equality. And a treaty means justice. Thank you.
You're listening to Radical Radio on 3CR. 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and podcasting and streaming on 3cr.org.au.
On this week's episode of Women on the Line, Jen spoke to 44 Flats United, a group of residents, former residents and supporters of public housing organising against the Victorian State Government's decision to demolish 44 high-rise commission flats and a growing number of walk-ups across NAM. Jen interviewed Arku Tran, leader of 44FUNT, a Vietnamese woman living in a housing estate in Richmond. In this interview, they talked about the major problems with the estate demolition plan, what impact this is having on the residents, and how 44FU is organising on this campaign. Here is an excerpt from the episode that aired yesterday, 25th August 2025.
My name is Arku. I am the leader of 44 Flats United, or 44FU. And
my name is T. I live in 139 High Street, Richmond.
Wonderful. And can you just tell listeners who is 44 Flats United?
Yeah, 44FU is a group. We're a group of residents and former residents of public housing and supporters of public housing. And we formed over a year ago in response to this policy to demolish all 44 high-rises across Melbourne and additional walk-ups as well.
So in 2023, then State Premier Dan Andrews announced that the state would demolish and privatise public housing in Victoria, specifically the 44 residential towers across 22 estates, including Carlton, Flemington, North Melbourne, Fitzroy and Richmond and a few others, which we can talk about. These lands would then be converted into a mix of public and private housing, but it has been unclear from the get-go where the current residents would be relocated.
Mm.
2 years on, can you give us an overview of where this issue is at now and what are the major targets at the moment?
Yeah, for sure. So like back when the announcement was made, there was such little information. In fact, the only thing that was communicated to residents, if they even got that comms, was that the building was old and needed to be retired and that they would be expected to move out within years or decades. So incredibly vague communication. The only thing that they announced in September 2023 alongside this announcement was the first lot of buildings that they would demolish, or they say redevelop, which is essentially demolition and being rebuilt. But the first lot of buildings that they want to demolish, they're referring to as Tranche 1. 1 year later, and that's where Auntie T lives, they announced Tranche 2, and Auntie T's building's part of Tranche 2. So that's 139 Hyatt Street in Richmond. So all they've told us so far, the only thing we know for a fact, there are two buildings in Tranche 1 that are part of the Flemington Estate. Those will be demolished and they're going to be rebuilt as affordable housing and community housing. There will be zero public housing. So this is slightly different to what residents were being told in those buildings when they were told to vacate them, to be relocated out of them. back then there was so much confusion. Some residents were told that they'd be moving out temporarily because their building was getting renovated. So they were told to sign these relocation forms in the interim and that they'd be moved back in. But they had no idea that it would be demolished and rebuilt as something that wasn't public housing. Then there are others who knew what was happening or knew that it would be demolished, but didn't know that it was going to be rebuilt as community housing and not public housing. That news only came to light in, I think, March this year. Harriet Shing, the housing minister, announced it at a press conference that Flemington would be rebuilt as only affordable and community housing. And we have no news on any of the other estates, not Richmond, not North Melbourne, and we can only assume that they're not rebuilding them as public housing.
Yes, so just to clarify for those who might not know, including myself, what do you think they mean by the term affordable and community housing? Does that differ to public housing?
These are good questions, and the reason these questions keep getting asked by everybody, I feel like they use this terminology intentionally because it's misleading. So the term that they often refer to, like when I say they, I guess I mean the Department of Family Fairness and Housing and Homes Victoria, this plan is part of what they call the big housing build. And in that, they aspire to build, I think it was like 10% more social housing. So social housing is the umbrella term. And then under social housing, you have community housing and you have public housing. Outside of social housing, you have affordable housing. And as I understand it, there are various definitions for affordable housing. But a general working definition, I think, is that affordable housing is generally 10% less than the market rate, which is not actually affordable if you're thinking about the suburbs that these estates are situated within, like Fitzroy, Carlton, Richmond. It's 10% less than market rate is affordable housing, and that's completely private. Community housing, which sits under social housing, is different in many ways, different to public housing, despite what, on the contrary to what Homes Victoria will tell you, its main difference is that your landlord, if you live in community housing, will be a community housing provider, not the state government or not Homes Victoria. They will say that your rights are the same, that you have the same rights under the Residential Tenancies Act, but the reality of it, when you speak to people who have been moved to community housing, it's a very different state of affairs to when you're living in public housing. The main thing is that your tenure is different. In public housing, your public housing unit is yours for life. If you live in community housing, typically you'll be signing contracts that are a year long or 3 years long, and they can review it, decide that they're not going to renew it for you for whatever reason, and then you have no secure housing. So the tenure and the rate that you pay, the rent that you pay, are the two main differences. But we can go into the details of why else community housing has been really problematic for people.
So the Flats has over 10,000 residents across the metro region. How has 44FU been organising and uniting residents on this issue? And I would love to hear it both from your perspective as the founder of 44FU and also T as a resident who's engaged with 44FU.
Our goal really was quite simple. It was that there was a lot of good information that community groups, community legal centres had produced for public housing around this issue. And some of it was for public housing residents. And we knew just by virtue of being from community, that important information wasn't being shared with residents, those who need to hear it the most. The fact that no one really knew that there was even a class action happening against this, that most people didn't know there was a parliamentary inquiry into this, so the parliament was investigating the government for this decision. Just general things, basic things like that, and also the fact that the differences between community housing and public housing, they weren't communicated to residents. The only comms or information residents were getting was from Homes Victoria. And so our group's purpose was to get out there to all the affected buildings in Tranche 1 and Tranche 2 and to provide them with information that they may not have had access to. And importantly, interpret it for them. So a large part of the work we do is actually interpreting information. So luckily there's people in our group that speak different languages, and we've been able to do that. And it's to put residents in touch with each other, because that's where the strength comes from. Residents hearing from each other's experiences and learning from that, even learning like what kind of questions you can ask your relocation officers to get more clarity. That kind of stuff has been really important. But we've been organising meetings, mainly estate-based meetings, where we can share that information and think of ways that we can respond to it, to this decision, for those who don't agree with it. And then also to link up residents across the state, because people can learn from each other, especially those from the tranche one, from tranche two. They can learn a lot from those who've been through it already in tranche one.
Những lúc mà giống như là người ta bệnh hoạn á, khi là bệnh hoạn quá người ta lại có thể gọi bạn xuống giúp đỡ. Ô trời, nay tôi bệnh quá, tôi muốn không được khỏe, có thể giúp được cho tôi là cạo gió không? Hay là có thể đưa, nếu mà cảm thấy trầm trọng thì có thể gọi giùm tôi ambulance không? Có những cái rất là đơn giản mà rất là hiệu nghiệm, giúp liền cấp kỳ. Chứ họ không có thờ, không có cần phải qua kiếm một người khác, qua chính phủ hay qua một cái hội nào để giúp đỡ, mất một thời gian rất là lâu. Còn đằng này là nó sẽ thực hiện liền và giúp đỡ liền. Làm đó cho người ta một cảm giác rất là an toàn và người ta rất là thích và cảm giác giống như là một gia đình. Những người bạn ở những cỡ chung, người ta lúc có tình cảm người ta cảm giống như là bạn bè, giống như là người thân thuộc gia đình của họ. Họ không phải lo lắng nữa.
So Guti was just saying that the community is incredibly strong in Richmond. Residents there support, like provide all the support that they need to each other, and because of that they actually rely less on services within the community. So overall it actually saves the government money. An important point that Auntie T's making is that the government doesn't see this. There's a lot of the support that people are providing each other from, like, just like giving lifts to one another or providing moral support, looking after each other's children, cooking and providing for each other, like healthy meals. All of that saves the government money. People don't have to rely on external services. So tearing the community apart is going to ruin that fabric. It's also, it means that people won't have each other anymore. They will likely have to rely on other service providers, which won't be able to provide the same kind of support, same quality of support that they get from one another. But it'll cost the government more because people will have to rely on these additional services that they weren't previously having to rely on, including just going to the GP clinic and doing more checkups, or perhaps getting like mental health care plans, because they don't have the support systems that they're so used to having and have had for decades and that have allowed them to thrive. She also mentioned that even for those who may have like something like a gambling problem, they still like living off money that you get through Centrelink, and because of the supports you have in place through community, like social support, but also like all the various supports I've already mentioned, you still can have like quite a high quality lifestyle. Like you can manage, you can make do. You might even be able to still save a bit of money, like have some savings left. But yeah, overall, she's saying that because of public housing and because of community that exists in public housing, especially on her estate, it means that people have a good quality of life, and you destroy that and you destroy people's quality of life, and that will add up. That's going to cost the government more and more in the long run as well.
That was Arku Tren speaking, and T speaking with Jen for Women on the Line. Women on the Line is a radical intersectional current affairs program making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people. You can tune in to the show every Monday from 8:30 to 9 a.m. To listen back to the entire episode, go to 3cr.org.au/womenontheline.
Have you heard about the news that's come out of the NT?
What news? Fires, floods, chicken flu, what?
No, the payouts.
Payouts?
Compensation for what you went through.
No.
Well, I reckon you should go for it. You deserve every cent and more. I'll back you. You know it.
Oh, sis, you're the best.
Yes, I am. If you are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander and were removed from family or community in the Northern Territory before 1 July 1978 or in the ACT or Jervis Bay before 11th of May 1989, you may be eligible for the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme. If you know of a family member who was removed but passed away after the scheme was announced on the 5th of August 2001, you may be eligible to apply for redress for them. Call Link Up Victoria, VACA, on 037 002 3700 and leave a message for a callback or contact the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme on 1800 566 111.
A 3CR supporter.
So you're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on the 26th of August on 3CR 855 AM. Just to recall, we listened to Gentle Boy by Araminta earlier on today. That was a new release from this July by the Melbourne or Nam-based singer-songwriter who creates home-produced music that fuses modern feminine pop with folk influences. And after that, we listened to this week's episode of Women on the Line discussing the public housing crisis we are currently facing at the moment. Up next, we'll be listening to Alexis Fuentes speaking at the Pacific Peace Conference. The Pacific Peace Conference was organized by the Pacific Peace Network, which was formed in 2019. It stands on the shoulders of the nuclear-free and independent Pacific Organization formed during the 1970s to oppose nuclear tests. Representatives from Guam, Jeju, ROK, Japan, Northern Mariana, Vanuatu, Philippines, Hawaii, Australia, and New Zealand have held a range of events and actions over the past 3 years, focusing on military activity and exercises rehearsing for war. We will now listen to Alexia Fuentes, Secretary General of Bayan Australia, a multi-sectoral alliance of progressive Filipino mass organizations campaigning for peaceful independence. Speaking on the panel, Regional War Preparations, Talisman Sabre, AUKUS, and the Force Posture Agreements, Alexia discussed the rising militarism in the Indo-Pacific, focusing on the Philippines as well as USA's strategic interests in the region, and the people's resistance against global imperialism.
So, welcome everyone. Magandang umaga po sa inyo lahat. The Indo-Pacific has become central in US war planning. Amidst the war in Ukraine, genocide in Gaza, and tensions over Taiwan, the US is laying the groundwork for a confrontation with China. The Philippines is being positioned as a key proxy and military outpost in this inter-imperialist conflict. This isn't peacekeeping, it is war preparation. And this cannot be stressed enough. We need to call it out. We are witnessing a deepening global conflict landscape driven largely by US imperialism. Around the world, tensions are escalating. In Eastern Europe, the US and NATO continue to expand arms supplies to Ukraine while pushing NATO's reach eastward, prolonging the war and risking direct confrontation with Russia. In West Asia, the US provides full military and diplomatic backing to Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, fueling regional instability and triggering growing anti-imperialist sentiment across the Arab world. In East Asia, the US is escalating tensions with China through its provocations over Taiwan and the South China Sea, using alliances like AUKUS and Quad to militarize the region. North Korea and South Korea have increased missile tests and defense posturing largely in response to intensified US military exercises in the peninsula. Diplomatic tensions are rising. The US is applying pressure on countries across the global south, especially ASEAN nations, through economic blackmail, threatening higher tariffs, trade barriers, and sanctions unless they align with US policies. Washington is pushing nations to take sides in its strategic rivalry with China, undermining regional efforts at neutrality and cooperation. All the while, the US continues to provide massive military aid packages over $3.8 billion annually to Israel, $14 billion to Ukraine, and increasing military funding and support to the Philippines. In 2023 and 2024, the US earmarked over $100 million in military aid to the Philippines and urged it to increase defense spending beyond its growing budget. This year's national defense budget in the Philippines rose to approximately 256.1 to 271.9 billion Philippine pesos, or 4.4 billion to 4.7 billion US dollars, rising 6 to 12% annually, and an official push to allocate 2% of the GDP to defense, amounting to over 419 billion Philippine pesos, or 8 billion US dollars, much of it going to acquisitions aligned with US strategic interests. Now, this is not accidental. It is coordinated, and the US uses the threat of conflict and coercion to militarize allied nations, turning them into proxy agents for its global agenda. The Philippines, bound by colonial legacy and economic dependence, is a prime target in this global war machine. The semi-colonial and semi-feudal roots of subservience is the backdrop to all of this on why the Philippines is so open to foreign military occupation. Because it is a semi-colonial and semi-feudal society, politically independent in form but subordinated in practice to foreign imperialist control. Economically backward, dependent on foreign capital and ruled by a landlord elite, U.S. imperialism, bureaucrat capitalism, and feudalism form the root of our problems. These conditions enable U.S. troops, bases, and weapons to be placed on our soil. Now, these social ills enable and justify foreign troop presence, base building, and arms trade under the guise of security. The Philippine state remains a puppet regime, facilitating U.S. military goals at the cost of national sovereignty and people's welfare. U.S. imperialism maintains this structure to serve its economic and strategic interests. The Philippines is kept export-oriented and import-dependent, producing cheap raw materials like minerals, coconuts, bananas, and sugar, while importing costly finished goods and technologies. We become a dumping ground for surplus goods from developed countries, undermining local industries and agricultural self-sufficiency. Filipino labor is commodified and exported through the labor export policy, making OFWs, or overseas Filipino workers, a key source of remittances while preventing national development. This dependency sustains feudal land ownership and bureaucrat capitalism, where local elites enrich themselves by serving foreign interests and blocking structural reform. As a result, our economy remains underdeveloped, our people impoverished, and our sovereignty compromised. In this context, U.S. militarization finds fertile ground. Foreign troops and bases are justified as protection, while in reality, they reinforce the same exploitative order. Now, the Philippines has a few U.S. military agreements. The U.S. maintains control through three core military agreements, such as the Mutual Defense Treaty, which was signed in 1951. This Cold War-era treaty obliges both the U.S. and the Philippines to support each other if attacked. In practice, however, it has always been one-sided, justifying permanent U.S. presence and interventions in Philippine affairs, while the Philippines is expected to act in alignment with U.S. strategic aims. The second one is the Visiting Forces Agreement, or VFA, signed in 1999. The VFA allows U.S. troops to enter and operate the Philippines for joint exercises and training. It skirts the 1987 constitutional ban on foreign bases by classifying U.S. presence as visits. It grants exterritorial rights to U.S. troops, limiting Philippine jurisdiction and accountability over foreign soldiers committing crimes on local soil. Now, the third one is the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or EDCA, which was signed in 2014, but expanded in 2023. EDCA allows the U.S. to build and operate within designated Philippine military bases. While technically not defined as permanent U.S. bases, these agreed locations are under full operational control of the U.S., effectively serving as a permanent outpost for pre-positioning weapons, launching operations, and deploying forces rapidly across the region. These agreements were designed to preserve U.S. strategic dominance while eroding Philippine sovereignty. They effectively circumvent constitutional safeguards, facilitating the return of U.S. military control without formal base status. And the recent expansion to 9 EDCA sites, many near Taiwan and the South China Sea, directly aligns the Philippines with U.S. war preparations against China. The U.S. has already poured over $82 million U.S. dollars into upgrading these EDCA facilities. Not for national defense, but to serve U.S. logistical and military interests. These agreements don't protect Filipinos, they entrench our role as a subordinate pawn in U.S. imperialist strategy. Recently, in June of 2025, U.S. lawmakers proposed building an ammunition manufacturing and storage facility in Subic Bay. This revives the former naval base for American logistical and combat use. This also provides a more permanent presence of foreign military assets in the country, risking national sovereignty and Filipino lives amidst increasing tensions in the region. On the other hand, the Philippine Defense Department has embraced this proposal, showing how our bureaucrat capitalist elite and puppet comprador class are complicit in ceding national sovereignty and are at complete odds with the Filipino masses and their interests, which they are constitutionally duty-bound to serve and defend. The fisherfolk group Pambansang Lakas ng Kilusang Mamalakaya ng Pilipinas, or Pamalakaya, strongly rejected the proposal in the U.S. Congress to establish an ammunition production and storage facility in the former American naval base. In an interview, Pamalakaya National Chair Fernando Hicat urged the public as well as the legislators to reject the military installation that will make us a target of U.S. rival countries that pose potential threat to the national security and to the livelihood of Filipino fisher folks. We have already removed U.S. military bases from our soil. We are concerned that their renewed presence is aimed at using the Philippines as a strategic location for provocative actions against China, Hicap added. Now, we also have several military drills, annual military drills, being hosted in the Philippines. We have the Balikatan 2025 being the biggest ever, having over 17,000 combined troops, involving troops from Australia and other international observers. Advanced weapon systems like Typhon and Nemesis were deployed for the first time, simulating war scenarios directly near Taiwan. These drills are not neutral. They normalize and rehearse real future conflict. The U.S. is deploying its Navy Marine Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System, or Nemesis, armed with naval strike missiles along the strategic coastlines of the Philippines near the West Philippine Sea. The deployment of the U.S. Marine Corps' new land-based anti-ship missile systems, as well as other assets, including the Typhoon weapon systems and other organic ground-based air defenses used in the war games, only stoke further tensions and worry in the region, especially with worries that they may be left as a permanent fixture. And according to several news outlets, these weapon systems, strategically positioned along the Luzon Strait, are capable of reaching and hitting mainland China. Balikatan was also soon followed by the annual Kasanga Joint Australia-Philippines Military Exercises, where the ADF committed troops to be deployed to the Philippines in lockstep with the U.S. U.S. personnel and weapon systems utilized in these war games are also often instrumental in counterinsurgency operations against Filipino revolutionaries and civilians in the countryside, including peasant and indigenous communities resisting militarization of their ancestral lands. Not long after, of course, they have also launched the Talisman Sabre exercises here in Australia and Papua New Guinea to further expand the regional war preparations and containment of China under the auspices of the U.S. So we have to ask, who pays the price for all of this? It is the Filipino people who suffer, communities are militarized, indigenous and peasant farmers are displaced, and activists are red-tagged and attacked by the state. Environmental destruction follows every base construction. These costs are invisible in headlines, but deeply felt on the ground. According to Asia Pacific Research Network, in April 2023, activists and humanitarians who came from a consultation with communities on U.S. military bases were harassed by the Philippine National Police, and the activists include church worker Agnes Messina, who was also illegally detained in 2022 after a humanitarian mission in shelled villages in Gonzaga. A fact-finding mission led by the peasant group Dangayan Cagayan Valley was also barred from the armed forces of the Philippines from visiting the town of Asinga via Bagao, Cagayan, a campaign center for peasant farmers Tanggol Magsasaka or Defend Farmers, reports that similar patterns of harassment were employed against first responders who investigated the bombings in Gonzaga, Cagayan in 2022. Meanwhile, government-affiliated online trolls attacked and threatened those who joined the massive demonstration against U.S. bases in Tuguegarao on April 18, 2023. Residents of Cagayan expressed their opposition to the province, serving as a staging area for an impending U.S.-China clash. There are many more incidents we can cite which involve various human rights abuses and cases of harassment involving the presence of U.S. troops and other personnel as well as state security forces who protect these military activities at the expense of human rights and welfare of the Filipino people. We cannot also forget, of course, the Subic rape case of Nicole versus Daniel Smith or the rape slayer of Filipina trans woman Jennifer Laude at the hands of U.S. serviceman Joseph Scott Pemberton. In both cases, the U.S. stepped in and absolved the perpetrators with the Philippine government, allowing them to eventually return to the U.S. despite the ongoing trial and public outrage as Filipinos clamored for justice. U.S. imperialism is the number one threat to peace. We have to be clear about this, and it does not simply respond to regional and global conflict, it engineers it. The U.S. provokes and sustains wars to secure markets, extract resources, and dominate geopolitical rivals. It creates dependency through military aid, trade conditionalities, and basing agreements. It deploys fear and instability as tools to justify arms buildup and foreign intervention. In the Philippines, the U.S. military presence means being drawn into future wars, particularly with China. Continuing economic subordination through defense-centric spending, enabling state repression through militarized governance. This is not defense, it is occupation, and it must be opposed. The people resist. but we resist and we will continue to resist. From Bayan to ILPS, or the International League of People Struggles, from the homeland to the diaspora overseas, from the legal mass movements to the revolutionary forces in the countryside, Filipinos continue to oppose EDCA, VFA, and all imperialist impositions. In cities, we mobilize through protests, education campaigns, and legislative lobbying. In rural areas, organized peasant and indigenous communities resist land grabbing and forced displacement due to militarization. Filipino youth organize to expose how militarism threatens education, jobs, and national development. The people demand genuine land reform, national industrialization, and an end to foreign basing, and a sovereign foreign policy rooted in peace and people's rights, not imperialist dictates. International solidarity is also key. Your solidarity matters. Australians must oppose ADF's participation in war games like Kasanga and Talisman Sabre, question the militarization of the region, and resist AUKUS and Quad. We must challenge the logic of war being sold to us as security. We call for churches, unions, peace activists, and First Nations movements to support Filipino communities in struggle and develop stronger relations and mutual solidarity across the region. The fight for Philippine sovereignty is part of the broader global resistance to imperialism, militarism, and neocolonial control. International solidarity strengthens the people's struggle and helps isolate and defeat imperialist aggression. In June, an international conference on imperialism and wars of aggression was held in the Philippines. It was organized by various organizations from different countries that met together for stronger coordination to align strategies and promote collective action and solidarity. From this conference emerged the idea of a peace caravan. This peace caravan will be a series of internationally coordinated protests in September later this year. To conclude, U.S. imperialism is preparing for war, not peace. The Philippines and the region are being militarized at a dangerous pace, but people are resisting, and we must stand together for sovereignty, for justice, and for genuine peace. Thank you, Mabuhay ang Sambayan ng Pilipino, long live international solidarity, and down with U.S. imperialism. Let us stand together to defend peace and people's sovereignty across the world. There can be no genuine peace without justice, and no justice without national liberation. Maraming salamat po, and thank you.
That was the incredibly inspiring Alexia Fuentes, Secretary General of Bayan Australia. Alexis was speaking on the panel of regional war preparations at the Pacific Peace Conference and discussed the rising militarism in the Indo-Pacific, focusing on the Philippines as well as U.S. strategic interests in the region in particular. And yeah, an incredibly powerful call for the rise of people's resistance against global imperialism. We are running a little different schedule due to a few changes, but that's okay. We are now going to have a few CSAs and we'll be right back.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters on behalf of the Bumbanja Nation, my people who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
Next up, we're going to listen to a speech by Tasnim Samarkas, a Palestinian educator, researcher and organiser at a recent event called Radiance in Pain and Resilience, public lecture and panel organised by the Shufa Project. The event brought together a number of Palestinian academics and advocates to celebrate the launch of Dr. Sama Jaber's new book, Radiance in Pain and Resilience. But yeah, we're going to be listening to Tasnim, whose work explores youth political subjectives and imaginaries through storytelling and community-based research. And Tasnim's grandparents were displaced during the Nakba, and she brings both scholarly and lived experience to her writing and advocacy.
All right. Hello, Assalamu alaikum, everybody. Nice to be with you all. I hope the rally was good. It looked strong. I wasn't able to be there today. But yeah, I want to start with an acknowledgement of country. I acknowledge the rightful owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and want to pay my respects to elders past, present, emerging. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. And to premise, as the people who've spoken today, the discussion that we're having on the fact that sovereignty has never been ceded. Because a lot of the time, people think that's a slogan, but it's actually very meaningful to what we're discussing. When an Indigenous people have not ceded their sovereignty, then what they're up against is a white colonial state and entity that dominates through asserting its sovereignty against their will. And why I say that's relevant to our discussion is because we can't talk about healing or psychology or mental health without actually questioning what it means to be human and where these notions come from in the first place. So when we're talking about Gaza or the Indigenous people of this land, what we're talking about is colonial domination. And the idea comes from what bell hooks calls dominator culture. And it comes from that assertion that because I am stronger, I can dominate you. And because I am stronger and you are weaker, or because I am stronger, I can put you in a position where you are weaker. And not only that, but I will also disadvantage you by taking away your right to take back what is rightfully yours. And not only that, but I will also change what is rightfully yours and inform everyone and convince everyone and deny your right to it. So we, in the field that I work, that's where we begin. We question the notion, we question what we call Western man rather than the human, and we put forward conceptions of the human, not to universalize that, because we already have Western humanity made as universal, but actually to insert something different, which is the idea of pluriversality. And that means that within our world, there should be able to exist multiple ideas and conceptions and meanings to what it means to be a person and what it means to be a political subject or a citizen or a member in this globe, in this world that we live in, however you like to define it, that isn't premised on what came out of the Enlightenment and what came out of Western history, which came from, you know, the property owners, the elite, those were the ones who were considered actually within that category. And since then, there has been inflicted upon all of us and continues to be inflicted that idea of colonial domination and a hierarchy of race. So we can't talk about Palestine without questioning and being very clear that what we're facing is very much white supremacy. But within the Palestine context, of course, it's Zionism and Zionism's conception of the Palestinian people. So what I study is the paradigm of radicalization and the way that that is imposed to characterize young people in dehumanizing and racial ways. And that's very much reflected on Palestine as well. Palestinians in the current moment are denied the right to be radical in their being, which includes the right to resist. And the framework of radicalization and counter-terror has narrowed in on Palestinians over decades and decades what it means to be a Palestinian. So it's reconceptualized that. And so Palestinians are constantly having to rewrite it and assert their own definition of what that means. And they do that by standing up and saying, I am Palestinian, which means I will fight for my land. I am Palestinian, therefore I will face the occupation. I am Palestinian, therefore, as our journalists do, I will expose the occupation. When they do that, they are part of a cause, but they're doing something much greater. They are actually rewriting what it means to be a dignified person universally, but also what it means to be a Palestinian. Being Palestinian has been indexed to definitions of death, to definition of subservience, to definitions of terrorism, to definitions currently of being the new Nazis and of savagery. This is both anti-Indigenous, anti-Blackness, and anti-Muslim all at once coming together to produce the vile hatred and racism that then legitimates and aids and abets crimes of genocide. So when we say anti-Palestinian racism is deadly, that is the consequences of such characterizations and definitions. Narratives are powerful, and the narrative of Palestinians currently are narratives that index Palestinians to the subhuman or the non-human. But the non-human is a construction, and so if we want to dignify Palestinians, then we need to go there. We need to actually reclaim what that is. What is the savage? What is the native? This is what anti-colonial thinkers have done within the anti-colonial movement, whether it's Fanon, within the Black Power movement, within the US, whether it's within Asia. Freire put forward pedagogy of the oppressed. It's about decolonizing the self, which means putting forward a direct counter definition and counter discourse and narrative to the one that is constantly being fed to us. Leah spoke about how the characterizations of the colonizer and the lens and the gaze of the colonizer can be internalized. And that is very serious. We can't move past that and pretend that people, because they are of a resisting culture, will therefore be immune to the harms of the occupier. That's unfair, and that's actually dehumanizing itself. People are affected, and people do suffer. And I think the latest onslaught, because it's live streamed, has actually changed also our conceptions of being Palestinian. Because we, even though as Palestinians we have the stories from the Nakba, we didn't see, we saw in images maybe, but those of us who weren't firsthand witnesses, we didn't see the humiliation the way we see it today. What our journalists do, and what is so honorable about their work, is that they provide a narrative within the suffering, rather than provide just raw imagery of human beings being degraded and humiliated by their oppressor. That's significant for people who are being victimized to tell the truth that will move them through their victimization. And those who support the Palestinian people, all they need to do is hold space for people to walk themselves through to liberation. They don't need saving. They don't need funds for all kinds of projects based on Western models. And they don't need to be pitied. What they need is the space, and that space includes the space for the right to resist. Because if people who are occupied decide that that is their form of healing, then that will be the truth of their liberation. That is what has been said about every single group that has been subjugated. They've been called mad, they've been called, yeah, I don't want to repeat, you know, all these like nasty kind of characterizations, but people think that these terms are neutral. They've never been neutral. A word such as the word mad was created to degrade and incarcerate Black people. Today, the Palestinians are being spoken about, but not spoken to. If the Palestinians want to rise up in this uprising, to face the occupation, to say we will remain on our land, and even if all we have are scraps of metal to fight our occupier, then that is what we choose to do, then the world should stand by them, rather than continue to push all kinds of solutions in their face to tell them this is better for you. This is how you look after your children, by selling away your rights. That is unacceptable, and that is not a framework for healing for people who are traumatized because of the colonial occupying forces. We need to name the enemy, and we need to be very clear that our conception of wellness cannot be separated from the desire to stand up and to fight back and to stand very clear in our truth as a Palestinian people and the Palestinian nation. Thank you.
We've been listening to Tasnim Samak, a Palestinian educator, researcher, and organizer, speaking at a recent event, Radiance in Pain, Resilience, public lecture and panel organized by the Shifa Project. The event brought together a number of Palestinian academics and advocates to celebrate the launch of Dr. Samar Jabbar's new book, Radiance in Pain and Resilience. Up next, we have a couple of CSAs as well as a song. So stay tuned to 3CR Breakfast. This is 3CR on 855 AM.
Welcome to the Seaward District 3066.
Join us for a concert, speeches, and food at Collingwood Yards to raise awareness for International Overdose Day. Come together as a community, pay our respects for those that have passed and survivors, friends and families. Performances by Resident Frequency, catering by Food Not Bombs, supported by Inner Space Crew and CoHealth on the 29th of August, 2 to 4pm. Resident Frequency are a 3CR supporter.
You are a shadow, transparent, a memory once human. You pass through me.
3CR's radio program, The Boldness, is looking for women and or gender diverse volunteer presenters to join our team. Training is provided to all 3CR presenters. If you are interested in finding out more, please contact 3CR's volunteer coordinator on 03 9419 8377 or email volunteers at 3cr.org.au.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, and now we're going to be chatting to April Howard, who is a film producer of the upcoming documentary Voices of the Pacific. April has also recently attended the Plastics Treaty negotiations in Geneva as an observer and is here on the show to chat about the global threat of plastics in our oceans and the disproportionate impact on Pacific communities, as well as the upcoming documentary she's got coming out. But welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, April.
Hello.
Can you hear me, April? Yeah, great. Thank you so much for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast. Can you start off just telling us a little bit about, you know, why you're concerned about plastics in our oceans and, yeah, kind of what motivated you to, make a documentary about the issue?
Okay, so I've been lucky enough to do some work over in the Pacific area with a group called SPRET over a number of years. And because I was working with waste managers over there, it became clear to me how bad this was and that there was a situation going on that was outside of the OK realm. And I've always worked in, I guess, behaviour change and impact films and campaigns just in general with the work that we've done. But to add on top of that, when I was quite young, my grandfather sat me down and had a serious chat to me and warned me that plastic would choke the earth.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, it was quite foreign back then to think that, well, what does that really mean? And then the prediction came to pass and I'm standing on beaches at a cape with plastic and kids are playing in it. And this, the plastic's coming from elsewhere because of the transboundary movement of ocean currents. That on top of, you know, emerging nations and their infrastructure with, you know, goods coming in that at the end of the day have plastic in them or on them. And there's just a
an issue with stockpiling and how to manage it and where for it to go.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, such a massive issue. And, you know, as you're talking about as well, you know, this idea of, you know, plastic is crossing borders, you know, it's going across the ocean. You know, it's not, you know, what is, you know, produced by one country then becomes, you know, another country's burden to be, you know, living and faced by so many plastics. But can you give us, yeah, a bit more of a an overview of, you know, what your documentary is about and what it hopes to achieve?
Yeah, sure. So we chose the title Voices of the Pacific because we wanted to give voice to what the people are facing, but also represent what's happening with the animal kingdom and environments as well. So through the perspective of some islanders who have invited us into their homes and villages and told us what's going on and also sharing their fears about what's happening, we're able to use, I guess, the technique of filmmaking to shine a light on what's going on. But we want to make sure that we're also considering those other things that can't talk, because they're interconnecting with the substance as well in their, you know, in the water or on land. And because islanders are so interconnected with their natural environments, both spiritually and physically, they are also equally worried about those creatures that can't speak. And there's one guy in particular who speaks to us from one of the islands in Palau, where he's dealing with a whole lot of stuff that's just coming in from other parts of Asia. If you walk along the beach, you do your own audit and look at the plastic items that have washed up. And he's ended up putting together quite a significant installation as a protest. So he's strung up a whole lot of bottles and thongs as a way to, you know, tell the world that what's going on. And so in theory, the film itself, the ideal outcome for this is for us to get international distribution. We've been having some conversations already. We want to make sure it's the people in the countries that may be able to make change to support the Pacific that actually get to see it, because we have just had the treaty negotiations somewhat fall over. We probably have been covering that and aware of it. So the sixth meeting has ended up in no result of an agreement. And while on one hand you could say, well, that's a negative outcome, it's not, because the paper that was being presented by day 12 in Geneva recently had been attempted to be diluted to a point that it couldn't really stack up to the whole life cycle of plastic anyway, because originally the text was really wanting to take a look at chemicals of concern, volume, how much was getting made, where it was getting made, and also recycling. And then there was a sort of a process that went on where, I won't name the name of the countries, but there's some bigger impactful countries that are polluters, attempted to create a treaty that was not really worth that much. And it meant that those who were in the islands, for example, actually stood up and said no. So there's a group of 130 countries that have come together that are vying for a strong treaty to help address the whole pipeline and then protect all of us, so 8 billion people, no matter where you live. And so this treaty outcome wasn't ideal in the fact that everyone was hoping something would come to pass, but it was also a victory in another way, because they didn't accept something that wasn't good enough.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a, you know, a really kind of insightful way to think about it as well, that, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't want to be, you know, accepting or compromising and, you know, taking a solution that's not actually really getting to the heart of the issue. And, yeah, I guess, would you be able to speak a little bit more, April, about, you know, what you learnt from making the documentary about, Pacific Islander perspectives on plastic waste and, you know, maybe how they see that in relation to the rest of the world as well?
Sure. Well, when we were visiting some different island states, when we let people know what we were there to do, they were quick to invite us to their homes or local gathering places such as churches or schools to talk about what's going on. So I think in general there's just a genuine concern across the board about what plastic is and what it's doing. Then there's the situation where there was clear insight into the fact that they are up against, I guess, a stockpiling of the product itself that they have to work out a way to handle themselves. So there's often massive cleanups happening. They'll go on, you know, do their own work to make sure that the plastic's being picked up and the like. But then they have the question around what do we do with it next, because we have nowhere to, for it technically to go. There's not a whole lot of landfill facilities in these places, and then there's not a whole lot of land mass as well to handle the stuff. So this is all the things that no doubt the governments of those nations are now going to be looking at even more closely, that the treaty process is still underway because there wasn't a conclusion. But I think the broad picture as a filmmaker or a person who's been lucky enough to meet these people is that they genuinely are worried about what's happening for them, but they're also worried on behalf of everyone and everything. They don't want other countries going through what they're going through. They're just such caring people that the perspective of their culture is that we're all interconnected and that this issue is something that we should all be looking at. And I guess that's the part. You know, we're in Australia. I just heard my garbage bin picking up our yellow bin this morning. You know, I've popped some things in there and it's gone somewhere else that can be handled. They don't have a lot of that available. Those services don't really exist to that extent in those countries. And yet they're trying to find a way and to find a solution. So, yeah, it's a hard one and it's got multi-layers to it. And it's not just your bottles, it's other things like tyres and nappies and all those kinds of items and clothing. I guess one of the things Australians mightn't think about so much is how much plastic's in our clothing. So when we wash our clothes, it goes through our water systems and out to sea as well. And, you know, I don't know if there's a scenario where we could probably look at filters or look at what are we doing as well. But there's a need for just more discussion and more support on the ground for some of those countries that just genuinely need help.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it really sounds like, you know, I guess that's what the whole idea behind the treaty was as well. And, yeah, I guess thinking forward, you know, if that hasn't worked, you know, there needs to be other solutions. And I think just to the point you were making as well, April, about, it really seems like for a lot of people in Australia, the whole issue of plastics can be a bit out of sight, out of mind. And, I think, you know, hopefully through watching your documentary, it'll really make people think a bit more critically about, you know, the whole life cycle of plastics. Just to wrap up, can you tell us a bit more about, you know, how our listeners can find out more about the documentary and what the timeline is?
Absolutely. So if you wanted to go to voicesofthepacific.org, there's information there and there's a trailer on there. If anyone was interested in connecting to us in general because they may know about the issue or want to contribute in some other way or just get in touch, if they were to email me, april@rollingball.com.au, we'll always respond and also, you know, can include people in any communications that we, because we're regularly updating anyone who's shown interest so that they are on the journey with us. And so open to any of those things and collaborations, because I genuinely think this one is a scenario where we could work together to walk our way out of it. And there's a lot of work to do, but I definitely haven't lost hope. But the more we have these conversations, the more people are aware. And it's even if it's a subconscious level, you make change. Like I know for myself, it's impacting my buying patterns. I won't buy certain products, or I'll make different choices around how to manage things with less plastic in our life. And that would be the last thing I would say, is that encourage people not to feel helpless. Each one of us has got, you know, a major opportunity to contribute to this. And so, you know, all those little things add up. So that's the one thing I would say. Don't feel that, you know, your contribution doesn't mean anything. It does.
Yeah, that's so true, April. And I think, you know, it is really important to be, you know, maintaining that optimism and to feel like there is something that we can do, you know, to reduce our plastic pollution and, you know, to actually achieve the change we want to see. Thank you so much for joining us and making time, to chat about Voices of the Pacific.
Thank you. No, thank you so much for having me on. I'd love to stay in touch and keep you updated.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we've been chatting to April Howard, the producer of the upcoming documentary Voices of the Pacific, and we've been talking about the threat of plastics in our oceans and, you know, particularly that impact on Pacific Island nations. And you can find out more about the documentary at voicesofthepacific.org, and you can also contact April by emailing april@rollingball.com.au for more information about the documentary.
Beautiful. And yeah, up next we will be listening to a song by Emily Ullman called Hillside. Emily Ullman is a singer-songwriter based in Nam, and she will be releasing a new album, Severe Clear, coming up in October. So this is Every Hillside.
Scars. I pick myself up, dust myself off, and smile. I swear I heard a dog barking in the background of your record. It hurts my feelings that you don't know where I'm from. I listen so closely, I know so much about you.
Was Emily Ullman with Every Hillside, and she will be having a new album coming up in October. Up next, we will be listening to a segment from Indigenous Rights Radio. The International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition was observed on August 23rd, just a couple of days ago, and it honours the million of men, women and children who were subjected to the brutalities of transoceanic slavery and commemorates the uprisings and resistance that led to its eventual abolition. This day not only acknowledges the resilience and courage of the enslaved, but also recognizes the often overlooked roles played by Indigenous peoples. In various parts of the Americas and the Caribbean, Indigenous communities were among the first to resist European colonial rule and were themselves subjected to forced labor and displacement. In some cases, they provided sanctuary to escaped enslaved Africans, and in others, they formed alliances that changed the colonial systems of oppression. In this next segment, we will listen to an interview by Indigenous Rights Radio discussing bonded labor, which remains a widespread form of modern slavery in parts of Asia, particularly in countries like India and Bangladesh. It typically occurs when individuals are forced to work to repay a debt under exploitative conditions, often with little or no wages and no clear end to their obligation. Despite legal bans in many countries, weak enforcement and poverty continue to fuel this human rights violation. Cultural Survival spoke to Urmila Chowdhury to find out more.
It's power.
Bonded labor, also known as debt bondage, is a form of modern-day slavery where individuals are forced to work under exploitative conditions to repay debts, typically under exploitative conditions that trap them and their families for generations. In Nepal, the Tharu indigenous peoples in the Western Tarai region are particularly affected of this practice. Children frequently inherit their parents' debts and are forced to work as a laborer without fair wages, education, and freedom of movement. Bonded labor is globally recognized as a severe human rights violation, closely linked to ethnic oppression. The Kamaya system forces adult males from the Tharu indigenous community to work as agricultural laborers for wealthier landowners, while the Kamlari system targets young girls, typically aged 6 to 12, who are sent to work as domestic servants, often facing abuse. Although the Kamaya system was abolished in the year 2000 and the Kamlari system in the year 2013, challenges persist, including evictions and ongoing discrimination against Tharu indigenous community. Urmila Chowdhury, who was rescued at the age of 17 in 2007, emerged as a young advocate for survivors by founding the Freed Kamlari Development Forum. Her advocacy played a critical role in declaring Dang District bonded labor-free. In recognition of her efforts against ethnic discrimination linked to bonded labor, she received the Global Anti-Racism Champions Award from the U.S. Department of State in October 2024, dedicating her achievement to fellow survivors. An interview with Urmila Chowdhury was conducted on the occasion of the United Nations International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition, highlighting her journey and the ongoing struggle against bonded labor in Nepal.
My name is Urmila Chowdhury. I am from Dang. Chowdhury is one of the indigenous community and belongs to the Tharu community. And this Tharu community especially lives in Nepal, Tarai region. My organization is called Freed Kamlari Development Forum. Why I'm telling about my organization? Because I'm one of the Tharu youth leader too. In Nepal, especially in the Tharu community, there is one of the bad system. It's called Kamlari system. Kamlari system means a kind of bonded labor. But Kamlari is especially related to the child. When child becomes 6 or 7 years old, and they sent very far away from their home to work other house as a servant. I'm also one of the victim and one of the bonded labor in the Tharu community in the Kamlari system. Kamalar is a kind of bonded labor. Kamaya and Kamalari system, people, they say the same, but Kamaya system, Kamaya is especially the man and who work other family, but they live in their home. But Kamalari is a child girl, especially child girl, very young girl. Kamaya is different and Kamalari is different. When we speak and looks like similar, but and the bonded labor is what is similar, but work is not similar and age also not similar. Especially the Kamalari girls, they face very serious problem. When I already told you, when they become 6 or 7 years old and they become a Kamalari, regarding to my personal experience, when I was 6 years old, and my almost 6 years old, because I'm not remember all those things when I sent a Kamalari. My parents sent me a very far away from my home in Kathmandu, capital city of Nepal, and I stayed there almost 12 years. And there is no any right for me. I don't have right to play with toys. I don't have any rights to go to school when I feel sometimes sick. But there is no people ask you are sick or you want to rest or you don't want to work. Nothing. Just they say, Urmila, you can do this work. Urmila, you can do this work. And that time, I really miss my parents because I'm a child, and I miss so much my family when I'm sick. And sometimes it's a festival, and I really miss that to go home to enjoy with my family. But I cannot get the chance to meet my family. And it was really difficult for me because it's very difficult for a child to work at a house without any security. According to the award, it was very surprised and very much happiness for me, because I never thought that I am a child servant in my past life. But now United States Department of the United States in Washington DC, and they give me award.
You've been listening to Urmila Chowdhury speaking about child slavery and the idea of bonded labor, also known as bonded debt, which requires individuals being forced to repay a debt under exploitative conditions with little or no wages and no clear end to their obligations. We highly, highly recommend everyone check out the full episode, which is available on rights.culturalsurvival.org, which is the website of Indigenous Rights Radio. That's all we have for you today, but to recap the show, we have Juliet.
Yes, so a quick rundown of today's show, which was pretty jam-packed. So at 7:15, we listened to an excerpt from yesterday's episode of Women on the Line, in which Sen spoke with the 44 Flats United group, who are made up of residents, former residents and supporters of public housing, organising against the government's decision to demolish the 44 high-rise flats. And then at 7:45, we heard from Alexia Fuentes, the Secretary General of Bayan Australia, an organisation of Filipino community groups organising for peaceful independence And yeah, that was from the Pacific Peace Conference. Then at 7:45, we heard from Tasnim Samak, a Palestinian educator, researcher and organiser, speaking at a recent Shufa project event. And then at 8, we spoke to April Howard, a film producer of the upcoming documentary Voices of the Pacific. And then finally at 8:15, we heard recording from the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition, in a discussion talking about bonded labour. So yeah, that's our show for Tuesday, 26th of August, and up next will be Accent of Women. But thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.